Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is poet Leah Graham. Leah, welcome to the show. And we're going to be talking about your latest collection from the Hotel Vernon. Now, you're a teacher at Marist College?
Yes.
Where do you teach?
So Marist College is in Poughkeepsie, New York, which is in the mid-Hudson River Valley.
Okay. What do you teach?
Oh, I teach creative writing and in literature and basic writing classes.
Now, you got to tell me how you got to write an entire incredible collection of poems about the hotel here in Worcester called the Hotel Vernon.
Well, okay.
You came to be the poet in residence at Clark.
Yep.
Okay, Fiat Lux, my old alma mater from back in the protest days. Did you decide that you wanted to do a really questionable job? Because you went and became a bartender.
Mm-hmm.
So were you doing research?
It's a totally lunatic story. So I taught at Clark University for 5 years.
Cool. Classes in poetry?
I was there, you know, for all intents and purposes, and there's not a writing program necessarily at Clark, but I taught the poetry workshop classes.
Nice.
And I taught some travel writing classes and in lit and other basic kinds of, again, writing classes. You know, if you're a writer and you're a teacher, you kind of do all the kind of writing classes. And at the end of those 5 years, I was starting to go through a divorce, and simultaneously I got a tenure track job at Marist. And so you're
going through the changes in your life, major emotional changes, ups and downs.
Yeah, and I won't let you guess that the age it was, but anyway, you can probably start to think about, you know, when that might have been. And so, I was at the sort of end of my time at Clark and getting ready to transition to New York. And it was just a strange, you know, set of circumstances. A young guy and another Clarkie who was a graduate and kind of a friend of mine called me up one night out of the blue and said, what are you doing? I said, I'm in bed. And he goes, you're too young to be in bed. Come to the Hotel Vernon. And so I was like, that seems like, you know, auspicious. And so I went down, and it was totally funny. He goes by so many names, but his real name is Alan Grigg. Allie Bombs, who goes by Cool Kojak and a host of other names, who was during that time, so this is 2007, he was living in the hotel, and he was making a documentary at the hotel. And that I think still hasn't gotten completed, but I'm holding out hope at some point, because he's gone on to do some other interesting things in music and whatnot. But anyway, so I start talking to him, and he's a really compelling person, and he had done so much research on the Vernon. And one of the things that really interested me was the murals, right? So no matter what you think about the bar and all the stories that you've probably heard if you've grown up in Worcester, those murals are knockouts, right? And so he started to explain, you know, Joe Myron, who had been the son-in-law of the McGadys, who owned the hotel for so long, was a trained painter, Boston MFA, I believe. And his favorite poem was The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. And so he and his buddies in the 1940s, these other artists, painted The Rime of the Ancient Mariner on those walls. So you can go, and it's still there, and those are great. I think they're great, still great murals. There's something very pirate-ish about the, you know, the version of The Rime of the Ancient Mariner. But the other thing that he told me, and this is what really got me, was that there is one panel on the back wall that you'll see, and it's a bunch of sailors, Polynesian women with beautiful flowers in their hair, you know, and they're all on the beach drinking and whatever else. And it's not The Rime of the Ancient Mariner.
Not that I remember.
No. And it's also...
That was the other Samuel Coolidge.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly. It was his younger brother.
Yeah, exactly. alter ego. And it's also a much... I think anybody can kind of see that it's not the quite the quality that the other paintings are.
Okay.
And so Al told me, oh, that mural was done by Al Capp, the cartoonist who did Lil Abner. Now, I am from Arkansas.
Yeah.
And
so you suffer from Lil Abner stuff.
Yeah. But also for me, Lil Abner as a kid was the only way I got to see my state in a national way outside of school. Right? I mean,
but it was a New Yorker's version of Arkansas life.
It was, and Al Capp was quite something. But you know, I in so many ways, it's that connection. And it's always right. Our roots do something to us. And here I was, and I've lived in so many places. Name it.
You were born in Memphis.
I was born in Memphis.
You grew up in Arkansas,
Northwest Arkansas, right? And you know, lived in New Jersey a couple years. Lived in Chicago for 10 years where I did my graduate studies, and then lived here for a little over 7 years.
But wait a minute. So how does this all transition into you working at the Vernon?
Okay. So you see this
mural
done
by Al Capp.
Right. And I'm like, oh my gosh, first Arkansas is here. But also, this is the thing, right, that it really clicked for me, and places are really important to me.
Yeah, and I get that from your poetry.
They're really important to me. And it's precisely because of where I grew up, a place that is it has such a stereotype to it.
Right.
Poor, backwards,
right.
All of that, right? And of course, you know, the next thing is Bill Clinton, right? You know, that's the other, and however you feel about him, right? I mean, I happen to like him as my governor.
Right, right.
Right? He did a lot of good things for education, but other people don't feel that way, right? Anyway, so I had that moment where I thought, this is what Worcester, I had that great Worcester moment of like, the world's here. The world is here. I've had so many bizarro things around Worcester. Like, people walk in and they're from, Philadelphia, but they know my best friend from Chicago, that kind of stuff, right? And so that was a moment for me where I was like, wow, there's this Arkansas connection. And it's been sitting here under my nose, for 7 years, and I haven't been really paying attention. And in fact,
Right, you were in a bubble at Clark.
Yeah, I mean, I love teaching at Clark.
Clark is great.
It's fantastic. Right. But Worcester's hard. It's a hard place if you're not from here and you don't get it.
I definitely know.
Yeah. So it took me a while. And I've got – but the thing is, Worcester's one of those places that, once it gets under your skin, once you find an entryway, you don't want to leave. I think there's something that you can't let go of.
I think it's in the water.
It is. It's the Worcester water. Worcester water. Yeah. Well, that's what we used to call the well vodka there in.
So you decided to become a bartender for a couple of months?
Yeah.
You had bartending experience.
Yeah. And that's a whole other. So when I was in grad school in Chicago, right? I was at the University of Illinois there in Chicago, what was once called Circle Campus. I bartended at a jazz club that was owned by the mob, the grandson, I think it is, of Mad Sam DiStefano was my boss, and the widow of Anthony Spilotro, who, is the guy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know who he is. Okay. Yeah. So I worked at a jazz club called The Back Room for 4 years. And so I'm mostly, cocktail waitress, but I'd also done some
bartending. So you can mix drinks.
I can mix some drinks. Yeah. Oh my God. I hope my parents don't hear this.
So you decide to bartend at the Hotel Vernon.
So wait.
That's a tough gig.
Well, it is and it's not, right? Because what are you doing? You're not mixing drinks.
No, you're not mixing.
You're pouring dollar drafts is what you're doing.
Did anybody ask for Naked on the Beach or anything like that?
Sometimes
So you did get some.
Once in a while. And then you were like, yes. this is exciting.
A mixed drink.
It's a great night. I might actually even get a tip for this. Who knows,
You start writing poems right away?
I did. Well, okay. So not only did I meet Allie Bombs, but then I also met Bob Largis, who's another compelling figure. And so there was that. And then the other thing that happened was I had a going away party that we hosted there. And it was, so I read and Clark students performed and, you know, and it was a pretty crazy night. And it was packed. And I think Bob had this idea that I was going to bring all these people all the time.
Course.
You know? That it was like I was some big draw. And I was like, wouldn't that be great? But yeah. anyway, so it was a little bit of a carnival, right? Of like, he thought this, I thought that. Well, but I did. I wanted a job.
So was the pressure on you to like try to do stuff to bring people in?
Well, we did talk about that a lot of like starting a reading series and doing things like that.
That sort of seems natural.
Yeah, we did talk about that. But it was a little bit, I knew I was on my way out. I was in transition. And it's interesting, right? Because that, you know, the hotel is a transitional place, right?
Yeah.
So in some weird way, I was perfect. Right? But of course,
did you also understand from the beginning, and I need an honest answer here, Leah, okay? That this was going to be an inspiration for a series of poems. Like, did you realize, you sort of recognize it going, this is actually going to be worthwhile for me to do this?
Right. Absolutely. Okay. I knew from the get-go. And
it was like doing an internship.
Yeah. Okay. I knew. No, I mean, I think the moment that
some people choose Paris. You chose the hotel.
Hey, Worcester is the Paris of the 90s.
Come forget, I've lived here for a long period of time. And it became the Calcutta of the 90s.
Okay. All right. Maybe a little bit more funny. So, yeah. No, I knew from the beginning.
So you knew. You went into this as a poet.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
It was calculated. And I should say, later on that night, after hanging out with Al, he introduced me to Bob. And there was there was a resident who was there, this guy, Joey Lucas. I think he's passed on. And Joe, a lot of people knew Joe. He was a sweet guy.
Yep.
And he could play the piano.
Oh, nice.
And so I'm there with I'm there with Bob Largess. I'm there with this crazy documentary musician dude. And I'm there with Joe Lucas, who's sitting there we're all sitting in the ship room at, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning. And Joe is playing whatever he's playing on the piano, right? That untuned piano. But I was like, this is the most fabulous night of my life, kind of. You know, you have those.
Totally get that.
Yeah. And so I thought about it and I went to Bob and I was like, do you want a bartender? You know, and he was like, sure. And the first day that I bartended, I was thinking about this at first. I thought, well, it was the first day, the day that the cops came in and dragged the meth people out of the bathroom, or was it? And I thought, no, it was a wedding. I actually bartended for a wedding in the afternoon there. That was my first gig. And
that's memorialized in one of your poems.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm terrible with names. Well, I'm sort of terrible with names. But that couple I still see periodically because they're involved with the Blackstone Canal movie.
Do you want to read that poem?
Sure.
Why don't we take a poetry break?
Okay.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is poet Leah Graham. She's an associate professor of English at Marist College in Poughkeepsie, New York. She was the poet in residence at Clark University, and she has a new collection of poems that are really wonderful. When is it going to be published?
2019 from Salmon Poetry Press out of the west of Ireland.
That's interesting. And it's called From the Hotel Vernon.
Yes.
Now, the Hotel Vernon is a fascinating place. One of the things I didn't realize is the Burl Ives connection.
Yes.
Is that a true story?
It is.
Or is it just legend?
No. There's actually, if you go in there, there's still a photo of Joe Myron, who was.
When did that happen, though?
I think it was in the 50s or something like that. But there's a photo of Burl Ives and Joe Myron, who kind of look alike.
And he donated the wheel?
Yeah. I mean, that's okay. So my research was based off of some of Allie Baum's research that he had done for his documentary, but also I spent a good time in the library until a few years ago when I was coming back to try to do revision, somebody stole the file on the Vernon. Yeah, so it went missing.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, it did. But
it wasn't the filmmaker, was it?
He could have.
Because who else is going to steal the Vernon?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I wrote him, though, about it, and I don't think he had.
Well, who's going to confess?
Yeah, right. And why? But it did seem a little mysterious to me.
It seems very mysterious to me.
But yeah, no, I think that's in a newspaper article about Burl Ives. But I think Burl Ives and Joe Myron, I think what their connection was that they used to sail together. You know, they used to sail and fish or whatever. So, yeah.
You ready with a poem?
I'm ready.
Go for it.
April wedding at the Vernon Hotel. Plastic roses and chicken marsala and yellow cake. A boombox on the piano bench serenades us. Chantilly lace and put your head on my shoulder and young love. The kids on the sly buy PBR and say, our mother's not a drinker. They're all gray-suited in white socks, hanging around Millbury Street, leaned up against Narragansett in blonde brick. In her patent leather pumps in mid-60s, the bride processes down the ship room to let me entertain you. The groom is a map maker. No dancing except for the toddlers. They tell me later, oh, we're wild.
I love that poem.
Thank you.
When you go to a place like this, and when I hadn't read your other poetry, mm-hmm. I've just only read this, but immediately got a sense for a passion, for a sense of place, to try to capture a sense of place through the people and through the locations. Has that always been your case when you've been writing poetry? Is it a way for you to understand, for you to get in? It's like your entrance point into the place.
Yeah, I mean. You know, I think everybody has their core way of seeing the world, right?
Yep.
And mine is place because, again, Arkansas. And also because I grew up with storytellers. You know, I did. I had this fantastic grandfather who, you know, grew up really poor in the river bottoms of the Arkansas River, one of 10 kids. And, you know, his father was a sharecropper. And then, as things in America have changed, right? It just so happened. Now, he was also like a pretty handsome guy. He was a boxer. He was all this, right? And had a lot of charisma. But he also had a heart condition, so he didn't go to war. And so then he hooked up with my grandmother who had a little bit of money. She came from that part of the country, had some money, and had been to school. And, you know, he kind of struggled with that because he'd been pulled out so often to work on the farm and whatnot. And she said, I'm going to help you go to dental school. And she just had this bright idea that this is what he should do, that it was like a strategic thing. So she helped him go through dental school. And when he came back to Northwest, he went to dental school in Kansas City. When he came back to Northwest Arkansas, or actually really Western Arkansas in some ways, he was the only dentist within three counties. You know, because we're talking post-World War II.
Yeah, but that's actually still happening.
Yeah, right.
Right.
And my grandmother used to tell these stories about how the farmers would line up three deep around the dental office, right? So, you know, so he had sort of the luxury to tell stories, but he'd had this other really starkly impoverished background,
sure.
Right? And that's really still close to me, right? And so my way of seeing the world is that those stories, but also the geography. And I think if you're from a place like Arkansas, and much like Worcester in a completely different way, right? If you're from a place like Arkansas, in particular families, I have friends who don't see the world like I do, for sure. And they're from Arkansas, and they're, you know, lovely people and well-educated and the whole thing. And they don't see Arkansas this way. Well, this is how I see it, which is you feel a deficit, right? You feel like that where you're from doesn't count. It's not in a very...
Is that because of the attitude of the rest of the United States towards...
Sure. The South in general,
right.
You know, and
well, that's a different. Arkansas is really a different situation.
It is.
It's the Ozark kind of thing,
it
and
is.
So it's even less known than the traditional South.
Right.
You say Georgia or Mississippi, people have one idea. You say Arkansas, And people don't even, I bet most people can't even point out Arkansas on the map.
Yeah. Or they, you know, they say, so is that south? Is that west? I mean, it is a kind of interesting state in terms of where it's poised. It's poised net. Really, there's so much westernness to it. And remember, you have people like Judge Parker, the hanging judge, who, right? And you had all those outlaws went through there, right?
Leah, so, I just realized something. You can't not tell a story.
It's true. And it's
you can't answer a question with one word, can you?
I know.
You've never been able to do that. Admit it right here.
No, I no, you're right. You're absolutely right.
And so were you destined to become a writer of some form?
Probably. And I thought I would be a fiction writer when I first started out.
Now, when you get back to when you first started out. Okay. So at what point in your life, and I always ask this of every artist, at what point of that did you start doing that thing that's going to give you the passion later in your life that you remember and you're going, yep, I'm going to follow it through?
That's a really hard question.
I want you to think about it.
Yeah. I think, well.
Were you writing as a child?
Yes, I was writing as a child.
What were you writing?
Stories, you know.
But not for assignment for school, just for yourself.
Yeah. I remember writing like replicas of the childhood version of Shakespeare. I don't know. Anyway. I had read Macbeth.
Hold it. So how old are you? You're high school,
high
school?
I was probably 10, 11,
so it's like an Ozark version of Macbeth?
Listen, you know.
Were there hellbenders in it?
Oh my gosh, my husband wrote a book on hellbenders.
I love hellbenders.
Hellbenders are awesome. Yeah.
People who don't know they are, they're the largest, weirdest aquatic salamander that's in mainland North America.
Yeah. And if you're interested in, there's a great book of poetry that's quite well researched called Glurk by Mark Spitzer, who I happen to be married to.
Glurk.
And he did a lot of research around hellbenders, and he's actually done some radio podcasts on hellbenders as well. So.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
Well, so you're writing from it as a child, but you're not writing poetry. You're writing prose.
Well, I was interested in poetry too, but I didn't really, you know, I didn't know poets, you know, I did. Yeah, I knew.
What was the first poet that you read that clicked?
Well, I'll tell you, that's an easy one. It wasn't until I was really, well, no, I'll back up. It was in high school when I read William Carlos Williams. Yeah. And who I ended up doing a lot of work in my graduate work. In fact, worked with the poet Michael Anani in Chicago.
Wow.
Who had been doing a dissertation on Williams, and then Williams died and the copyright stuff.
Talk to me about the experience of reading a poet that finally clicked. Like, was there like this aha kind of a thing?
Yeah, it was the plums, the ice box, you know, this is just to say, you know, I've eaten the plums that were in the ice box. Forgive me.
So was that
me.
One of the turning points in your life, and that you thought maybe this is possibly what I'm going to do?
Probably not then, but what I was going to say before is in college, my sophomore year, I'm 20 years old, and the poet Carolyn Forché comes to campus. And, you know, and this was her really famous book, The Country Between Us, about El Salvador. Ooh, how prescient. Anyway, and she was, talk about a person with a lot of charisma and just beautiful and smart and could speak all these languages and down to earth and yet sophisticated and all that kind of stuff. And so that was the aha moment for me, because I was like, poetry, I thought at that point, poetry can do things in the world.
Cool.
Isn't that
You're
great?
Right.
Isn't
You're
that
absolutely
great?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was the real moment where I knew that's what I wanted to do. And I ended up doing a creative thesis. I went to Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, where Winston Churchill gave his Iron Curtain speech, right? It's this little tiny place in the middle of Missouri. And anyway, so I worked with the poet Wayne Zaid, who'd studied at Iowa. And he was super, just incredibly supportive, and still is a very dear friend of mine. And then I took a lot of time off, or it seemed to me, until I was in Chicago in my late 20s. And I went to the University of Illinois Chicago, got into the master's program, and then just kept going. And in fact, when I moved to Worcester, I was still finishing up my doctorate there, so I was having to go back and forth.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM Jazz Plus for New England. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is poet Leah Graham. And we're talking about her latest collection, which is going to be published next year, called From the Hotel Vernon. You should read another poem.
Okay.
Go for it.
Let's read the first one.
Go.
This poem is called Hotel Hood, and it's the first poem in the book. And actually, it's a little bit of a later poem than most of the other poems, in that I had started doing Oxford English Dictionary poems as a form.
What? Yeah. Okay. Explain.
What they are. Yeah. So I stole this, as all poets steal things, right? And
you're doing OED poems.
OED poems. And it's something I teach. That's what I always start with in my poetry workshops. Because we all have favorite words, or we all have, yep. or words we hate, or words that, you know, just stick in our brain and somehow. And so one summer I was teaching a summer program, and I'd been teaching this, and I was like, well, I'm just going to write along with them. Sometimes I can do that, sometimes I can't.
Explain to me how this works, though. What is it?
You choose a word. You go to the Oxford English Dictionary. And
now, what's the process of choosing the word? Like, is it just your favorite word, or is it something like more exotic?
Well, sometimes it's just favorite, but for me, I really like words I don't know.
Yeah.
We all, you know, and actually, I'm going to just tell you this. So a few years ago, one of my friends from elementary school, back in Asbell Elementary in Fayetteville, Arkansas, one of my friend Stephanie, wrote me and said, you know, I was so jealous of you when we were in like fifth grade, because you used to read the dictionary for fun. And I was like, wow, what a great thing to remember, because I didn't remember that. And then I thought, I still do that. That's, you know, I think that all poets probably have some kind of love affair with dictionaries and
so you,
and
just to look at words.
Yeah, just to look at words. It's so
interesting.
Just
to learn new words.
Right. So you choose a word.
Malcolm X did that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He was great for that. Yeah.
Yeah. He loved aardvark. Seriously, he did.
He wrote
a little piece about learning about aardvark.
That's fantastic.
So, okay, go ahead.
So you choose a word and you think about it through its definition, right? Through its etymology, the history of it, right? Which sometimes gives you lots of interesting things.
Sure.
I mean, words like sad that we think, like, how interesting is sad? But of course, when it started out, it meant sated. It meant enoughness. And Chaucer plays with the switch over between that sated, that satiation, and then melancholy. Like, there's a moment in the Canterbury.
So originally referred to that feeling when you've had too much.
Right, right. Yeah.
Where there's sort of a guilt feeling, like, I don't want any more. Yeah, and that turned into that makes me start to think, was there sadness before?
Right, right, right. Yeah, it's all in the word. Nobody was sad. They're only full.
Everybody was full.
Yeah. Well,
it was good times in the medieval period. Everybody was happy. Nobody was sad.
So you've got the etymology, then you've got connotations, right? And some of these are public connotations, right? Like now, if I say to my students doubloon, and they say, oh, you know, it's a Spanish coin. Right,
yeah,
pirates.
Yeah.
And I say, all right, keep going. They're like, oh, Pirates of the Caribbean. And I'm like, yeah, keep going. Johnny Depp. Okay,
right.
There we go. And so you've got those public ones.
So you're doing word association.
Yes, but then you've got your own personal associations, right? And then we talk about sound. You want to think about sound, how sometimes a word sound does more for you than its meaning.
And doubloon is a great example of that, because it's got incredible sound. Yeah, doubloon.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what one of my assignments, and so it's an assignment that I've given myself, and in fact, I'm working on the OED odes as we speak right now. So I'm writing a bunch of these.
She's actually doing it while she's doing the interview. It's amazing. You can really multitask. I'm really impressed. Leah's just a writing fool.
Yeah, yeah. I wish. No, I'm actually, Mark, I'm quite a slow writer.
Oh, that's an interesting thing to know.
I'm very slow. Yeah.
Do you have a time of the day you like to write?
In the morning.
You know, a lot of writers say, and I have to say that when I'm writing, and I don't write, I write reviews.
Yeah.
I love to write when I first get up and everything's quiet.
Yep.
And are you one of those people that really can't have anything else going on in the room?
Yep. Well, jazz. I'm good.
I can't even do anything.
With no words. If it's no words.
Okay. So then instrumental jazz.
Yeah. The Canadian writer David Arneson told me, and this is during my Clark years, I went up to Winnipeg where he teaches, and he told me at some writer's party, don't give the best time of the day away to anyone but yourself.
Oh, right.
You know, keep that
right,
for
that
yourself.
Sense.
And I was like, I've always remembered that. So,
yeah. Yeah, it's interesting that you went up to Winnipeg. And you know, I think about Arkansas. I think about places like Winnipeg within the context of Canada.
Yeah.
And it's in the middle of the...
There's a lot of connection there. There's, in fact, and so that's, I feel like I'm pimping out all of my work here, but my chapbook from This End of the World, Notes to Robert Croach, has a lot of connection between, who was a Canadian writer and a kind of mentor for me, is really a lot about the way I saw Canada and Arkansas and the West together.
It's like how Americans view Canada. Which is like sort of as like a cartoon or a second class thing.
Wasteland.
Right, the Great White North, and the Mackenzie brothers and stuff like that. And that's all we know about Canada.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's this amazingly vital, varied place that has wild variations in cultures.
Right.
But it's got the same kind of coastal situation that we do.
Mm-hmm.
So you get Vancouver on the West Coast.
Right.
And then you have all the big cities on the sort of eastern side.
Right.
And in the middle is like the Arkansas area where people have no idea when
you're Chicago even.
Chicago's like a major.
Well, that's true. Winnipeg's not anything. But it does it has a kind of Chicago-y feeling, but like a really diminished size, I think. You
okay.
know? But yeah, anyway.
You've traveled a lot.
I have.
Do you want to read your poem?
Yeah, but I'm happy to talk about travel too, but let's read a poem first.
Read a poem.
Okay, all right. This is Hotel Hood.
Okay.
Noun, the fact or state of being a hotel, rare. Where I found myself that summer bartending at the Vernon, leaping over the longest oak bar in the city that first night to wake the young Pole who had laid his head on a table, the drool starting to pool, and when he finally wobbled up, Patsy Cline booming crazy from the jukebox, grabbed a dollar draft from Joe's grip, yelled, Zimney Pivo, and chugged before running down Milbury Street into the night of this neighborhood, once called the Island, then Green Island, now the Canal District, though the canal lies beneath Harding Street like a quashed rumor. A revolving door of cops, hustling meth couples, slow dragging the checkered tile at noon, Orbison's only, the lonely, reeling out the orange door, a list of scratched patrons hidden behind the register with crucifix and Hershey bars. Mike, the human Ferris wheel, Big Jug's genie, Fat Ron and Damien for dealing in the John, visits from the baker who lived upstairs, fed his mice crackers and nips, shat himself so regularly that Captain Bob withheld his $25 until he bathed in him pacing bar to street, muttering, it's my fucking money. Stories of first loves spinning and jolting White City's carnival rides, doing it in Indian Lake rowboats, lost loves and practical jokes on Water Street. Each night, the warrior came for his mail, shadow-boxed himself in the mirror, bellowing, I'm the warrior. Want to dance? Circuitous, roundabout, recurrent, so much talk, a chaplet of sojourning, a refrain with endless verses. Why are you here? What do you need? Where are you going? Can I help you?
These poems are really wonderful, and my reaction to them has been in sort of in parallel. First of all, it's about a place I know, and I've now lived for a long period of time. I've lived here since 68.
Yeah.
But the other point, there's a universality about the kind of people that hang out in a bar like the Vernon Bar. Like, you could go to a bar in Philly. You could go to a bar on the West Coast. Maybe not the West Coast. But anywhere on the East of a bar of a certain economic thing – and there's going to be a series of stories.
Yeah.
Bars are a weird place. People are much more vulnerable in a bar, or are they letting stuff out in a bar?
Well, I mean, they're liminal spaces, right?
Yeah.
You know, they're the in-between. They're a place that you sort of slip out of your life, right?
Oh, you do.
So many ways. And also think about that. You know, we call alcohol spirits.
That's right.
Right. And so to think about that here, people, it's a place where people are imbibing other kinds of spirits and is bringing out another kind of spirit in them. So it's, they're a weird place. I mean, bars are wonderful in that. And I,
well, know, where things are happening when you imbibe alcohol, I mean, that's changing everything.
Yeah. Right.
It may make you more of yourself in one way and more of a different person in another way. Like, I know, as a matter of fact, I don't drink a lot, but when I do, I become very Smurf-like. And I'm only telling you, which is one of their, you know, and I have a certain facade of serious sort of crankiness that I like to, and I just get like, I'm one of those people who, if I get slightly inebriated, I just get silly.
Yeah.
It's not a good look for me. So the thing about bars is it's got that thing going on where for some people it's a way of life. Yeah. That's their way of life. But there's the other people for which it's – and then there's the meth heads.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's funny. I'm glad you bring that up because this is something that I've been trying to write an essay about. That, yeah. I mean, I haven't quite completed this yet, but I've been writing about shame and about the, you know, about writing this book and that there's something sort of shameful about it. And
wait a minute, there's shameful about
my interest, right? Why would you want?
Were you a voyeur? In other words.
Yeah, right. Well, there's that, right?
Okay.
But
the pieces come off more. First of all, you're bartending.
Right, I'm one of them.
Right, you are one of them, and there is that sense of participation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But aren't we a voyeur in everything?
Yeah,
and I mean seriously, I'm a voyeur here, like interviewing you.
Right.
So
right.
I mean. Right. We're nothing else other than that.
Right. And there's all you.
But you don't pass judgment in these.
No.
There's no judgmental aspect of any of these poems.
Thank you. That's the highest praise because that's, of course, you know, that's something I'm quite worried about, right? And that is like.
You don't want to add on to the problems that everybody else has.
Right. I mean, I think of, for me, the Hotel Vernon, I mean, there's all these fantastic stories that people would come in and tell me all the time. Like, and just by.
Were you the only woman bartender?
I wasn't the only woman, but I was one of the rare ones, you know? And I think at that point, I was.
People have to gravitate. Unfortunately, there's a sexist thing.
Yeah. And it was at that point, not this isn't true anymore, but at that point, I think I was the youngest woman bartender.
Okay.
Right. There's some young guys there, but.
Well, what's this thing with keno cards?
Oh my Lord! People would come in and they would write love notes to me on Keno cards, and I was so naive at first, anyway. And I would try to run them, and you know there was nothing
like
you know.
Would you like oral pleasure? Is one of them.
But it was also
break my heart.
Yeah. Would you please break my heart? Was one of
that's
them.
That's like so sad.
Oh my gosh! Right? It's fantastic stuff, especially if
was that the same person who wrote the other one?
Possibly. So, possibly.
You know, I've been out of the bar game so long. Yeah. Is that a thing that people do? Like, you write weird stuff to the bartender on the Keno card?
Remember, Mark, this has been 10 years. My life is so different now that I don't know if people still do that or not. But why not? Yeah, it's weird. But it was also, you know, for a while, like, and in fact, I still have this. I have a whole collection of Keno cards of people who wrote different things. Now, sometimes they weren't that, right? Sometimes they were, you know, like they were lists of things that people, I would actually assign some of the regulars little writing assignments.
Wait a minute. You're teaching classes as you're bartending in the Hotel Vernon.
I confess. Yes, I did. And
you can't stop, can you?
Yeah, no. I always wanted to be a teacher too. Like it's simultaneous for me as a writer and teacher. I'm not one or the other. I think I'm both. But yeah, so I
how did people react? are people reacting to that? Like, I just came in for a beer and a shot, and now I've got an assignment.
Oh, yeah, no, they loved it. I mean, they loved it. I mean, I didn't force them. I just said, hey, you want to write some, why don't you guys write some haikus? And I told them what it was, and so then.
Yeah, if I ask a guy in a bar, hey, you want to write some haikus? No, it's not going to have the same kind of reaction.
You're going to get beat up, or something.
Okay.
Yeah,
or the thought I'm trying to pick them up.
No, but remember, these are regulars. They know me at this point.
Okay.
They know that I'm the idiosyncratic
bar experience when they're in with
exactly.
you.
Exactly. Yeah.
So they're not just going to get the bar and the shot and the.
Right. Right. Well, also, I remember I was also writing. I would sit behind the bar, especially when during the day, and I would write, you know, when I was busy. Right.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But that also sometimes, sorry, Bob Largess. Yes, I was writing while you were paying me. But the other thing was that, you know, there was a lot of mental illness, and that actually was the thing that probably got to me more than drugs or the alcoholism.
The history of that is interesting within Worcester, because there used to be Worcester State Hospital.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, all their outpatient treatments faded away. And so a lot of people were put back on the street that have serious issues and are not getting the treatments that they should, or the care that they should. And that's just part of growing up in Worcester. And I feel extremely, extremely concerned for them.
Yeah. I mean, I know it's very cliched, but, you know, when it was a full moon, you knew it. Years before that, you know, when I was in my 20s, I worked for a very brief time at a homeless shelter, right? And so I'd already known that. We used to, you know, overstaff on full moons because for this very reason. So I was kind of aware of that. But even during the day, I'm not joking, there would be some people who would come down and they would howl as if they were howling at the moon. And so there was a lot of that. And that in the end, I think, started to really get to me more than anything else. Like, I could have handled all the other ugliness.
Is it a sense that you couldn't do anything about it?
Yeah, and also it also got to be intrusive on my own process, and you know, as a writer, and I was like, I need some time away from. I just need quiet. I can't, you know.
Totally understand.
Like, it was one thing if everyone was well behaved, and
but it wouldn't make good poetry.
Right. Exactly. right.
No, and then you start feeling guilty about that.
Of course, you do, and I think that's
what you were mentioning before, that you're in this weird tension between what makes a good poetical experience, and the actual people that I'm observing to inspire that poetic experience. And I think there's always going to be that tension, like, when am I not helping?
Right. I mean, I think the thing that I've been thinking about a lot is how, for me, and you know, I've always, writers, you know, are, and I'm sure, you know, radio hosts as well, are curious, curious people.
Right.
And there's something that's great about that, because curiosity, you learn so much, you're always interested in why and, you know, the backgrounds of things or what have you. But also knowing things can be burdensome. Right. And so there's something.
It stays with you.
Right. And also, once you know something, right, about someone or a place or what have you, it can lock your thinking up, right? And so you always.
Oh, explore that with me. So, in what way?
Well, so for instance, if you say the Hotel Vernon, oh, stay away from that place. You know, there was a murder there in 19 or whatever. I'm making this up. Right. I'm not a psychic.
And that's forever how you. First thing that comes into your mind now when anybody mentions that will be that.
Exactly. And so you always, as a writer, want to also preserve your innocence, right?
Got it.
And so it's a tricky line there between you want to know, and it's knowing things also makes for good writing, but you also want that fresh perspective. And so the fact that you told me that you don't see any judgment here just really delights me, because that is the last thing that I want.
Well, let me tell you, I was looking for that too. Oh,
interesting.
Because reading your background, knowing your situation, I was going like, what the hell is she doing? Is this her way of like playing the exotic, you know, like going to the exotic place and trying to, you know. And then what I found instead is a person who is immersed in the situation.
Yeah.
That's in the midst of it and is just sort of reporting.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I will tell you this. So
artistically reporting.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And there's definitely, as you read through the book, you could probably see there are poems in here that are real, like, artistic experiments. And,
okay.
Yeah.
And I want to have you read one. There's a Debbie Harry. Okay. I just love that poem. And as a matter of fact, it should be like put to music or something. I love that poem. But I'm a sucker for Debbie Harry, because that's when I was on the original, head of the rock department. Of course, Blondie was like huge.
Yeah.
but what a wonderful poem. And it, like, there are times when I read stuff like this and the whole idea behind it makes perfect sense. This made perfect sense to me.
Well, that pleases me so much, because this is one of the sort of oddball poems in so many ways.
It's a little stands out, different from the rest of them.
But remember, too, that one of the things, if you're a bartender, you're constantly connected to the jukebox.
The jukebox is referred to a lot.
And I actually did a lot of research on jukeboxes and learned all kinds of things about jukeboxes. They were quite democratizing. So anyway, so let me read this poem and then we'll talk about it. All right. So this poem's called Ishmael Writes to Debbie Harry. Call me across ocean reveries. Call me from against the spiles. Call me at the spouter inn into the wailing church on time. Call me with side lunging strides. Call me your top 40 hit. Hum through scrimshaw comb beat by pelican foot. Call me the 18th sexiest protagonist. Your blubber boiler lover. Poet of the horsehead doldrums. Call me anytime. Sea pen. Your fiddle heart urchin. From CBGB's toilet and graffitied brick. Call me Queequeg's bitch, je m'appelle Ishmael in the voice of Sid Vicious. Call me a Ted Bundy escape plan, an outlier's alibi, a Nantucket sleigh ride. Roll me an ambergris from narcotizing sightlines to Max's Kansas City. I'll never get enough. As Jericho was called to the Medusa, as Mocha stove the Essex, as dice of drowned men's bones, call me to the go-go, the Playboy mansion, Rockaway Beach, or rock and roll high school before the trill of your high. Call me your number one, jawbone prosthetic, your heart of glass, your new wave, your stub or Starbuck or flask, your three-chord Tashtigo, your dreaming Sunday cannibal, your 30,000 shark teeth, your humpback rhyme master, breathe like a pod of right whales at midnight into my ear. I could be your stabilitus loci, your garden of amorphous concealment, your finny tribe or spiracle, your rapture.
That is so good.
Thanks. I love that poem. I do.
I really love that poem for so many different reasons, but it really swings.
Thanks.
It really does swing.
Well, I felt like
Talk to me about writing that poem.
Yeah, I just felt I had this moment.
You're not old enough to remember all that music, are you?
Yeah, I am. Yes, I am. But thank you.
Well, then you're very well preserved.
Thank you. Thanks. Good genes. Thanks, Mom. That just works.
I can't explain it. It sort of rolls off effortlessly. And that part's part of why it's special. It just sort of swings on down the line.
Well, and it also it's pushing up against some of these more narrative poems, right?
Yeah.
That are a little terser in sound. Like I was reading some this morning, before I came over here, and I thought, wow, these are blunt. And I thought, well, of course they are, because they were stories people walked into the bar and told me.
Right. It's like the equivalent of the Keno card.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but yeah. this was the craft, right? And so I thought to myself,
you're right. It is the craft.
Yeah, it's the sound that I was going for here. But also, I just thought, I can't write a book that's set in Massachusetts without Moby Dick, right?
And I got that.
Yeah, like you had
it was
to.
Like you were under pressure to have the Herman Melville moment.
Yeah.
And you're in this freaking bar that's got the Rhyme of the Ancient Mariner and the Wheel of Burl Ives.
Right.
You have to go there.
You do. I mean, and at least the rumor is that the ship room in the Hotel Vernon, the bar, the ship room, which is the place that people, those of you who don't know, it's an entertainment space, right, was modeled after the architect who designed it. It was this French architect in the 1940s who modeled it after the second birth of the Mayflower.
Right.
Okay. Who knew? So whether that's completely true or not, I'm not quite sure. This book came very close to being called Rumors from the Hotel Vernon. So, just so you know.
And it's weird. It is weird that there are rumors about bars in Worcester. There's a bar called the Aurora Bar, which is on Main Street. When I first came to Clark way back in the day, which I'm not going to give out, the rumor was that Veronica Lakes was still there. That she lived in the Aurora Bar, and like you could see her at the bar, And she was like really old and sort of, and then she was like trying to pick up young guys. And people would tell you seriously that she saw them, they saw Veronica Lake in the bar.
That's great.
But I'm wondering if there's something about those kind of, if the bar is around long enough, they're going to.
Right. But, I mean, we.
But something about the construction of the Verdon just sort of from the beginning sort of seems like, how odd.
Well, I mean,
you sort of lucked out.
Yeah, I did. I was so incredibly lucky. And also, not just lucky to have, you know, found
met a huge group of interesting people.
Yes. I mean, whether it was Allie Bums or Bob Largis and all the people that were there hanging out at the time that were regulars or were working there. Kathy Waters, who I dedicated a poem to, who was a longtime bartender there. And, you know, she, like, people gave me all kinds of context and they really helped me to understand.
And so the other reason for doing poetry like this is to memorialize those relationships that you've really sort of given back what you got out of this relationship.
I hope so. In a lot of, almost all
unfortunately, you've made it so special that people are going to start making pilgrimages to the Hotel Verdon.
I think Bob Largis would love that.
That's right.
I think he would like that.
He finally earned your keep.
He's like, I knew I hired him.
You'll bring in the business.
Yeah, it only took like 11 years or something. But
for him.
Yeah, a lot of these guys, though, that are there, a lot of the characters.
I hope they're going to sell copies of the thing
absolutely.
At the Hotel Verdon.
Yours is in the mail as soon as.
No, at the Hotel Verdon.
Oh, yeah. I plan to do that.
They should have it on the bar.
They should. They should. Yeah.
And people should write Kino cards and make comments about the poems. And there should be like a contest. A Kino card contest every year. The Leah Graham Kino card haiku contest.
This could make us. This could
Seriously.
Make our.
I'm not touching this. Yeah. This is your baby. This is amazing. I mean, it is going to. It is. Yeah. It sort of points out a landmark and helps create. It adds to the stories that are already there. So you're now part of that. So there's going to be the stories about the crazy poet woman who bartended and got interesting Kino cards.
And I also had some nights there myself. So there.
Oh, really?
Oh, I did. Yeah, I won't lie.
No,
there's a few nights that I think people will be like, and I saw her, and I'll be like, okay, what can I tell you? Okay, Yeah, sure. But I think that's also part of being there, right? It has its effect. If you're, you know, when you're a bartender, you're either part of that scene or you are really strict about not being part of it, right? But for my purposes, I was like, this is like a vacation summer for me, right? I've got this crazy writing project in this crazy place. And I'm out of here. And so, you know, when you're in transition, right, if you're transient,
right.
You give yourself some permissions that you might not otherwise do. But yeah, but anyway.
We're going to run out of time.
That's great.
Now I want you to read another poem.
Okay.
So pick one. Pick one. As long as I get the Blondie one in, that's cool for me.
Okay. By
the way, I want to mention the fact that Leah actually mentions Maurice the Pants Man.
let's do one that starts off with Maurice the Pants Man.
I think it's so great that Maurice the Pants Man is now memorialized in poetry. That, Leah, that just like made my year that I got to read that.
Well, I have to just tell you that all of my friends here in Worcester knew Maurice the Pants Man. And I am so sad that I never got to meet Maurice.
I got pants from Maurice the Pants Man.
Oh, man. You are
lucky. And it's always Maurice the Pants Man. So there's a pause there.
Yeah.
It's Maurice the Pants Man.
I'm going to try to read it that way.
Go for it.
Okay. Well, so this is actually the only other OED poem in the book that comes near the end. And this this poem's called Namecouth. And Namecouth is, as you might know, an obsolete word, an adjective that means known by name, well-known, famous, notorious. And, of course, it's rare. Let's say Maurice the Pants Man. Or Rizzuti's Goodnight Cafe, what used to be Old Billy's Lounge, now charred on Milbury Street, down from what was once Stony O'Brien's, where your gram used to sit with her boyfriends into her 60s drinking gin and giving you and your brother and sister quarters for the jukebox. Now called Nick's, because Vincent and Nicole are so in love, says Captain Bob. let's say, the Greyhound that used to be Rafferty's, and before that a name I can't pronounce in Gaelic, and where they say the baker was blown and shat that girl, and I wonder which corner or John or how much stench that place, that dark place where we all go to watch the World Cup with Richie Scales, Alley Bombs, bells and whistles. Everyone, you tell me, has another name or several better known than their own. Giant Jesus and Baby Jesus, Husky Jay and Bakery Joe, Trojan Mick and Pac-Man Pat, Lord Pork Fat Ron, Polish Stosh and the Warrior. Even in Texas, Michael mentions the Vernon to Sue, his liquor store gal from the Woo, who gives him the thousand-mile stare. She says, "Bucket of blood," and we were told to look away, cross ourselves in the street when passing that place.
It's a beautiful poem.
Thank you.
The person who actually invented the term Wormtown was one of the rock DJs here at the radio station. It's LB Worm.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. And he's a cool guy to this day.
Well,
And very, very serious about the fact that he was the one that coined Wormtown.
Well, that's the most, right, that is the probably the most famous of all of the monikers for Worcester. And in fact,
and it was amazing to know the person who actually did it.
Like, yeah. And there's also well, he's an eco writer mostly, but Worcester's very own David Gessner.
That's right.
Wrote one of his, I think his first book was called Wormtown.
That's
and
right.
Has to do with Worcester. Well, the thing, the Clarkies, the students I used to work with, they're the ones who called Worcester the Woo. And
I don't like the Woo as much.
I know no one except me does.
You like the Woo?
I love the Woo because I think there's something so truthful about it. It woos you in the most bizarre.
Oh, you're just such a poet.
Yeah,
stop it.
Bizarre
just stop being a poet
way.
For a minute. Stop your little poetic ways.
But let's see. There's Wormtown, the Woo, and then of course there's all the pronunciations, right?
Woosta.
Woosta.
Well, one of the weird things is because I interview people around the world is when all of a sudden they'll mention the name Worcester, a lot of them will go Worcester.
Yes. Right. Right.
And I have no idea what that goes from. Hey, I want to mention, you have two other books out.
Yeah.
You have one, is it Ho and Helix, Where and Here, and You?
Yeah, it's Hawk, right?
Like is that how it's pronounced?
Yeah, it is. And it's one of those things that...
It's an interesting word because
it's
like slew.
Yeah, right. It's one... Yeah, I know. And this... So that's maybe my only regret about that crazy title is that everyone, you know, it's Ho, Who, you know, whatever... But it's
Hawk and Helix, Where and Here, and You.
Yeah, what a crazy title.
Is that one of the poems in the book?
It's a line from the book, from one of the poems in the book.
And then you have a chapbook called Calendar Girls. For people, you know, a lot of people hear the word, but they don't understand what a chapbook is.
A chapbook is, it's a mini book of poems.
For a lot of modern poets, that's the way to go. I noticed that more and more poets...
Yeah.
Are going the chat? What's the attraction of chapbooks?
I think you can do something really specific in a chapbook. That oftentimes when you're writing a longer book of poems, that you feel like you need more amplification, right?
We're out of time. The amazing thing is we went through an entire hour and we only meant to do 30 minutes. My guest tonight is poet Leah Graham. And we've been talking about her latest collection of poems, which is going to be coming out next year, called From the Hotel Vernon. She is an associate professor of English at Marist College in Poughkeepsie, New York. She was the poet in residence at Clark University. Leah, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Mark. Likewise.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.